That's correct. In fact, Larry found a revenue rule that was published back in 1975 dealing with that very topic about, can a citizen of the United States be a resident? Larry, you want to throw some light on that?
Yeah, Gary, but I have to open up my computer. The screen is taken up totally by the video conference, so I cannot open up my Explorer. Can you? But in any event, this was a question posed and answered in a revenue ruling. And the question related to, well, when is a citizen and a resident? And the revenue ruling expressly states, hey, the only place where we find that a citizen's a resident is when he's outside the country. And that's basically it in black and white. But I can't tell you that revenue ruling because unless Joe could tell me how, when I'm looking at this screen with these Zoom features on it, the taking up the whole thing, I cannot open up Explorer. Is there any way that you can reduce this?
You ought to be able to shrink it, Larry. That should be up in the right-hand corner. You should be able to shrink that screen.
Well, basically, from memory, Larry, I recall it says that resident of the United States does not necessarily mean a distinction between a place, but they're just saying that a resident of the United States, a citizen of the United States is not a resident of the United States for purposes of the tax. Unless a citizen is.
Well, I'd like to be able to pull it up. Gary, do you have the same problem that I have? You can't open up Explorer?
Yes,
if you're involved in this video conference?
Yeah, and I got another laptop sitting to my left, but the hard drive's not connected to it.
Can you click on the Zoom icon, Larry, and that might help to minimize it so you can get around on your desktop?
Or we can just tell everybody to remember, Revenue Rule 75-489, and we'll bring it up next time.
Yeah. I got it, Joe. I now can do it.
Cool.
And what I'll do, Joe, is I'll email it to you so that you, I will quit participating for a minute and I'll email it to you and come back on after I've emailed it to you.
Boy, we're high tech here.
Okay.
We're working on it.
So who's got the table next? Who's speaking?
Well, I don't know, unless you can speak and email at the same time, Larry, we could maybe have Gary make a few comments about what Sean presented.
Yeah, I'll while Larry's looking for it, I'll throw in some comments. Sean has done a tremendous amount of research into this Social Security number and banking and how this disclosure and how it interacts with when you walk into a bank and you want to open up a checking account. They're going to say, we need to see your social. We need two forms of ID. I actually tried this and walked in. And they said, we need two forms of ID to open up your bank account. They said they wanted to see my driver's license and wanted to see my Social Security card. And I said, well, the Social Security card I have says not to be used for identification. Can you just open my bank account with a driver's license? I got my driver's license is valid. It's got my picture on it. It's a good form of ID. And said, well, what about a passport? Do you have a passport? We could, so they're gonna press you. If you've ever even tried it, they're gonna press you to turn over a Social Security card. And what's really strange about the whole thing about this, and Sean, I would welcome you to give your opinion on it as well. But based on what I understand, your signature card, your check cashing signature card that you sign when you open up a bank account, is virtually a W-9. And it's just verifying your status as a United States person, which, you know, I think that everybody's going to find out one of these days that they're a United States person. They're going to like it. But there's people out there that are kind of resistant to it, and I don't blame them. Yeah, it's good to have some, you know, some discussions on the topic. But the long and the short of it is that, you know, these words and terms, like Sean said, are very, very critical. You know, you have the law, and then you have, you know, guidance, you know, such as the Internal Revenue Manual. But in these very finely worded regulations, just like we discussed briefly a little while ago, 1.1-1B in the regulations to Section 1 of the code, you know, it gives you the impression that all citizens of the United States, wherever resident, you know, but, well, everybody believes, you know, hey, Bob, where's your residence? Oh, my residence is in, you know, blah, blah, blah. And they think it's a street address where their house is. That's their residence. But for tax purposes, residence has a very, very specific and very special meaning. And citizens of the United States cannot be residents of the United States for purposes of the tax. You know, that one phrase is worthy to research and, you know, take your first step or your 10th step or your 1,000th step toward really understanding how clever these law drafters are. I'm telling you.
They love to use our ignorance against us.
Indeed.
I wonder, as far as the Social Security situation, if you have people, not necessarily in a rural area, but that would probably be more likely, where you really, you know, you're branch manager of the bank in your town is your neighbor. You know, he's in the club with you, and he might sit down and actually look at your evidence, look at your research to see that, in fact, wow, I guess I don't need a Social Security number. Even if the bank auditors come and drill me, I can show them, no, I've got sufficient identification from this person, and it didn't involve a Social Security number. You know, but chances are, if you bank, as you know, many people have to, with the big, you know, national, international banks, they're just treat you like a number, and they're not going to, you know, give you the time of day. But for those who live in an area where, you know, your banker is actually your neighbor, you might have a better time at it.
Well, you know, Joe, that brings, I think you've hit on something there, because as we were going through these manuals here, during the show, as I was explaining, the manual says that the verification, the types of verification that you're requesting, depends upon the size of the bank, the location of the bank. So I think you might have something there. The smaller the bank, apparently the rules don't apply if the bank isn't a big international bank or a and it's in a small geographical area like a rural bank, because that's exactly what the manual said.
And yet the laws and procedures apply to them all, right? But in the age of too big to fail, you know, we're just a bunch of numbers. We're not customers. The banks and these, you know, the big tech, nobody, the laws don't apply to them. You know, they can make their own laws and bribe the right people and contribute to the right political campaigns, and they'll do just fine. But the rest of us who actually do the hard work in the country, you know, we get sent to the back of the bus.
Right. Well, you know, one of the things about the banks is they're as uneducated. These people that are at these banks, especially your low-level people that are going to be opening up your bank accounts, and even their managers, I don't believe for a minute they have a clue what's going on. But when you start going to the bank and you start climbing up that ladder and you bring in this type of research and these manuals where it says, for example, as you were talking about, Joe, the bank size, location, and customer base, including types of products and services used by customers in different geographical locations, matter as to just how they're going to go about obtaining and verifying your identification matters a great deal. Just for giggles, even if you don't want a bank account, start going to different banks. Come in, so I want a bank account. Not interest bearing, so you don't have to worry about reporting anything to the IRS. I want a checking account, real simple, personal checking account. Here's the money I need to open it. I'll pay your monthly fees. You want a social security number? I'm not going to give you one. Now, here's the information that says, according to your own manuals, the government's manuals, attorneys that write these manuals, I'm not required to give you a social security number. You're not required to ask for one. You can, but if you're still satisfied with my identification, you don't have to ask or require me to have a social security number. And by the way, if you don't give me a bank account without a social security number and checking account, wouldn't that be discrimination? And wouldn't somebody be liable? Maybe you ought to take this over to your risk management department and talk to one of your legal counselors about this. In other words, my point is the way you educate people, even banks, employees at banks, banks are made up of people. You start dropping these seeds in their ear and they go home. If you make a big enough deal about it and leave them with enough information, people are going to eventually start thinking about this. That's how you get people educated, is you make them think that, you know what, maybe what I've been told isn't the truth. Could that be possible? Could it be possible our government's lying to us? And I think back and say, nah, yeah, actually it is true. That we have to plant that seed.
At a minimum, you're going to see living, breathing, walking, talking, cognitive dissonance as as you show them the proof that they're not required to get a number from you, and they keep on demanding it anyway.
Yep.
Are you ready, Larry?
Got on the screen if Larry sees it. Did Larry?
That's the one I emailed to you, Joe. That's revenue ruling issued back in 1975. You know, if you want to get your hands on a copy of this, I don't know whether you could just do an internet search for that revenue ruling, but it is contained in the cumulative bulletin. And all of the cumulative bulletin goes back to 1919. The IRS started publishing things that related to its regulations in the cumulative bulletin. And they've been publishing it since 1919. You know, there's typically two volumes every year. There's, you know, like 1975-1 and 1975-2. So here you'll find this. You can go over to the IRS website. You can download every volume of the cumulative bulletin. For years, I worked with the hard print, the actual books. But I'm glad now that the IRS has scanned and made available on its website all of the cumulative bulletin. So you can get a lot of, you know, you can get regulations, a lot of other important information, more than regulations, like revenue rulings. They get published in the cumulative bulletin. So this will be in 1975-1 or 1975-2 of the cumulative bulletin. I can't see the page number here on the screen.
I think it's dash two.
Okay, all right. But you know what we want to note for everybody is what's bolded in yellow on the screen. Joe, can you move it up a little bit so we can read the whole thing? Or at least I can. No provision, the other way.
Stand by.
Can't you use that sidebar? Pull down the sidebar.
There you go.
No, but pull it.
You seeing it now, Larry?
Yeah. No provision. Well, and now it's, can you move it over some? Now you got still some of it cut off. Yeah, there, that's good. No provision of the Internal Revenue Code or the regulations thereunder holds that a citizen of the United States is a resident of the United States for purposes of its tax. Several sections of the code provide federal income tax relief or benefits. Oh, that's exactly what those sections do, relief or benefit. To citizens of the United States who are residents without the United States for some specified period. And so these references to section 911, 934, 981, that's all, those are sections of the code that deal with citizens outside the United States. And, you know, when you read those sections, you reach the conclusion that, well, the citizens they're talking about are described as citizen residents. And, of course, this constitutes an acknowledgement by the IRS that the only time we ever talk about a citizen being a resident is when he's outside the United States. Oh, that's real important for giving meaning to other important regulations. Am I correct, Mr. Gary?
Yes, sir. In fact, Section 911 is citizens abroad, 934 are
citizens in possession,
and the 981's been repealed. So.
Yeah, that was back in 1985.
Yeah, and I like the recognition in that same paragraph in the revenue ruling that's not highlighted, Larry. These sections give recognition to the fact that not all the citizens of the United States are residents of the United States.
Well, that's the reason why the distinction between domicile and residence is so blooming important.
Yep.
You know, not the you got to remember, you know, the best way to look at the United States government is kind of like a house. And imagine that house, what it does is it protects you from the external elements. Inside the house, there are 50 people. Inside the house, those 50 people are self-governing. However, the house itself, it's going to regulate and control what comes in and out. And the United States is really a house for the 50 states of the Union. It does regulate what comes in and out of this country. And that's his primary jurisdiction. You know, when this country was founded, the primary revenue of the federal government was duties and imposts, and that was involving taxes on goods flowing across the borders. That's what I call the inherent jurisdiction of the Treasury Department. And they've always dealt with, you know, hey, when they deal with citizens outside, citizens abroad in diplomatic circles, they're called citizens resident. You know, we have ministers in foreign countries. They're called ministers resident. And, you know, when you take a look at the federal laws, you know, since the statutes at large have been, there was some North Alabama lawyer that almost 20 years ago scanned and converted to text, converted to text the entire United States statutes at large, making it word searchable. And, you know, I've searched through the United States statutes at large, finding domicile. Congress uses the word domicile. Even in some acts, it will define domicile in the way that we mean it. And in the income tax regulations, domicile and residence is defined in the way that we're using it here. And so 1.1-1 of the income tax regulations describes citizens wherever residence is party subject to the tax. So it's real important. You know, one of the things that I find is important, you know, people can't just do things like listen to programs like this, you know, look a little bit around the internet and find something interesting and then believe it. You know, one of the things that really convinces you of the correctness of your position is to start digging in and learning this stuff. You know, it's legal, but, you know, the legal stuff is not impossible to learn. In fact, you know, lawyers, when I was in law school, we used to come up with this view, you know, you could train a monkey to be a lawyer. You know, all he has to do is, you know, sit down and you got to stick your nose in the book and keep at it. Well, you know, I think a lot of people need to do that. You know, the legal materials that we need to look at in order for people to comprehend and understand the tax laws, I've got it all posted over on my website. You don't have to leave the comfort of your home. You can sit in front of your computer and download all the old tax acts and all the old regulations. And there's a lot to learn. And once you start getting into it, you know, it's very educational.
Gary, now that we have that on the screen, you want to just repeat what you said just to point it out to the audience?
Yeah, thank you, Joe. Okay, 1.1-1B is the sister of 1.1-1A. And with, I just want to point out some things, and I'm sure that most of you are familiar with these distinctions, but I just want to bring them up for the people who would find it curious to see why they do what they do. So, for example, although 1.1-1A is not up on the screen because of 1.1-1B, let me just say that 1.1-1A...
There it is, Gary.
Oh, okay. Thank you. You know, the saying that the code imposes an income tax on the income of every individual who is a citizen or resident of the United States, and to the extent provided in 871B and 877B, the income of a non-resident alien individual. So there's your three individuals. There's only three. You know, we can all remember this. There's an individual who is a citizen, an individual who is a resident and a non-resident alien individual. There's only three in the whole code. So that's 1.1-1A. Now, I want to just point out one thing. After we've already kind of got the three characters lined up. Now, section one of the code imposes income tax on income of every individual who is a citizen or resident of the United States. Notice that in 1.1-1A, it's very simple. Citizen or resident are mentioned in the same phrase, right? So let's keep that in mind, and let's walk over to 1.1-1B. Now here we are looking at 1.1-1B, and in it, it says, in general, all citizens of the United States, wherever resident, well, and all resident alien individual. They have them separated there. So a citizen or resident of the United States in 1.1-1A is separated from the resident alien in 1.1-1B. And I'm gonna share with you guys something that took me 2 years to figure out. And I'm laughing because it's true. All citizens of the United States, wherever resident, are citizens outside the United States, in my view. And then all resident alien individuals are separate from citizens wherever resident because, and it may sound crazy, but just hear me out. Citizens of the United States wherever resident are outside the United States. All resident alien individuals are within the United States. And so they can't say, in general, all citizens are residents of the United States wherever resident, because a resident of the United States is a resident in the United States. And so that's one of the clues that begins to unlock the 150 people they had sitting in this room conspiring to craft these two regulations, in my opinion. And of course, yeah, call me a conspiracy theorist.
Nah.
While we're on this section, go down to C, Joe.
Yeah, there's, yeah.
And this is something I want to ask everybody. I'm not going to say anything about this. But the citizen is one that every person born and nationalized in the United States and subject to his jurisdiction. And that's a real important phrase. And a lot of people get tricked by its meaning. And I would suggest that, you know, you rely upon what the Congress of the United States, how it uses that phrase to determine the meaning of citizen. That's all I'm going to say.
Where could they study more about that, Larry?
You can download all the United States statutes at large. Now, there's a problem. I'm getting ready to mail some money to John Rowland, but John Rowland, unfortunately, is having a troubling time during his life, so I'm going to provide him the money in the morning to get Constitution.org up and running again. But John Rowland has over on his website all of the old statutes at large that I converted to text almost 2 decades ago. But you could also go over on my website, you can find links to the official government statutes at large that have been here within the last 5 years posted on the internet. They're word searchable. And you could also, you know, engage in your own study of, you know, use the search terms, jurisdiction, go through and find out. It's real important to do searches through the statutes at large. You know, I have Adobe Acrobat, and so when I find a word I like, I pull it out and highlight the phrase I like, and I stick it over and I save it in a particular folder. But, you know, if you don't have that ability, you can either print it out, what do you find, or, you know, just keep a little running diary, so to speak, of all the hits that you get regarding a certain phrase. You can also print them out, highlight them in yellow. That's what I do in PDF, highlight them in yellow. Then once you get a whole bunch of research done regarding the use of or the meaning of a certain word, that's real important. and subject to the jurisdiction of the United States has a, is a synonym of, you know, I think almost wherever resident. Would you agree or disagree, Mr. Gary?
I agree. Yeah, there's a lot of chatter about citizens. You know, are you a citizen? Are you a state citizen? Are you a U.S. person?
National? Gee.
You know, there's a
John,
lot of...
Were you... John, before we started the program, you said that one of your friends wanted to hear something about national, which is a popular issue right now among in certain circles.
Yeah, he was trying to distinguish between a national citizen, a U.S. citizen, or a corporate citizen. And he was wondering what your thoughts on that might be.
About national?
Yeah, national, corporate. He was saying that he was reading something about that somebody was writing distinctions about a corporate citizen, a national citizen, as opposed to a United States citizen, with all these adjectives thrown in front of a citizen.
Well, I'll give you my explanation of what national means. National is a term that first gained circulation, so to speak. It gained its use in the early 20th century. And I've seen here within the last, 10 years, a segment of the people that, the Patriot Movement, that's looking into matters like this, they've latched onto this view that a national, that's what we are. We're nationals. We're not United States citizens. We're United States nationals. Well, I strongly disagree. And the reason why I disagree is I'm going to explain here in a minute. And the way you find out, you can't just, there's too much rumor, gossip, and hearsay constitutes, valid legal authority in this movement. Too many people just, whatever the grapevine's saying, I'm going to believe. Well, that's extremely hazardous. I've seen a lot of people go down that road. They just listen to rumors and hearsay on the internet, act according to it, and then they find themselves in a world of trouble. That doesn't make sense to me, but it's what people do. And the same thing has happened with this national. I see fake Judge Anna and a whole bunch of other people. I'm a U.S. national. That's the position that they have. Well, let me tell you about what U.S. national is. The first time it is ever used by the Congress of the United States is back in the 1920s. And, before that time, the way Congress would refer to us, as American citizens or United States citizens or U.S. citizens. But then you also got to remember that, Congress has also come along. The 14th Amendment authorizes the federal government for people subject to its jurisdiction. The government of the United States can grant citizenship to them. And so it's real nice for you to be able to turn to the specific acts and the statutes large where Congress has come along and made groups of people citizens of the United States. And boy, they do it in the territories and they do it in the insular possessions. And boy, the 14th Amendment manifests itself in Title 8 of the United States Code, which deals with immigration and naturalization.
Absolutely.
And, but it comes out, that's the name of the title, but the name of that act was Immigration and Nationality Act. And, you read that 1940 Immigration and Nationality Act, and, Congress is coming along and making citizens of the United States people in the insular possession who prior to that time were nationals of the United States. Now, if you want to see a collection of statutes that deal with and making a distinction between a citizen and a national, I'll tell you where I've got it posted on my website. Now, when you get over to my website, it's the Dixieland Law Journal. Do an internet search for that because I stuck it up on my ISP decades ago. It's become so heavy and I don't want to move it. I haven't moved it over to my URL.